This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Good life, but you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
Mrs. Dunaway said, buy the flowers.
Sally, I think I'll buy the flowers myself.
Don't stomp your little lassies and Prada shoes at me, honey.
Is butter a curb? Snap out of it.
But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy? Security.
I can't stand to have you touch me. I can't stand to have you look at me. Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty. I can't stand it anymore.
John Callio, will you go round with me?
What a strange girl you are.
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
You have no idea how bad it gets.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for him.
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
You bitch! I wish I knew how to quit you.
Good evening. You are on Outtakes. This is the queerest film show in the country, possibly the world. We haven't really verified that, but I feel comfortable saying that, making that claim.
I'd agree with you.
My name is, of course, Daniel, and I'm joined in the studio by Alan Tuxford. Alan, welcome into the studio.
Why, thank you, Daniel. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's been a while since you've been in the Joy Studios, hasn't it?
Been quite a few years.
But you, of course, were part of the pioneering team behind Pink Popcorn, which was the last cinema show on Joy.
Yeah, that's right. So working with Kylie Eddy and Paul Tonter and Thomas Caldwell, so...
Well, it's
great to have another. It's great to have another movie show on Joy.
Well, our movie awesome. Show is a little bit different to the program that Pink Popcorn led with, because of course we are all about queer representation, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. But we do need to flag that today is an important day.
Golden Globes.
Golden Globes, absolutely. A lot of people are talking about it, but a lot of people aren't talking about it, and that's why we've decided. Not to spoil it.
That's right.
What I'm going to say is that it's surprising. As ever, I think the foreign press have completely, you know, who knows how they make the decisions they come to, but there are some really strange choices this year.
I just can't wait to find out who's won in the musical category, because I think The Martian was...
There was a total of zero musicals nominated, and, you know...
Yes.
Yeah, don't get me started.
I think that's going to be the highlight of my TV viewing this evening.
Well... We did talk about Golden Globes last week, and that reason, I think we've decided to get back to basics this week. So This week on Outtakes, we are looking again at homosexual representation, and we're asking essentially two questions. How has homosexuality been represented on our screens?
Mm-hmm.
And the second question is then, how has that representation shaped homosexual identity in turn? And
yes.
It's a bit like, you know, the old...
It's the chicken and the egg.
It is. That's exactly what I was looking for. So We've enlisted someone far more knowledgeable than ourselves to co-host tonight, haven't we?
Indeed. I'm really excited to have him with us.
It's such a thrill to welcome Dennis Altman to the Outtake Studios. Now, Dennis's reputation precedes him, but for anyone who is not familiar with his substantial contributions to academia and to the question of homosexual culture or politics, politics.
Yes.
Dennis is a very well-established Australian academic and pioneering gay rights activist. He's also widely published. Perhaps his best-known works include Homosexual Oppression and Liberation, which the Minneapolis Times called the best-written book on the subject, and
wow,
also The End of the Homosexual.
Praise.
It is high praise.
Very
so,
high praise.
Dennis.
I'm sitting here staggered by how you bridged up a quote from a snowy Midwestern city that is older than you are, Daniel.
Do you know what? I've dredged up, so I should say, some other quotes. Do you want to hear those too?
Probably not.
No,
I think you should save those. Maybe there'll be a special Golden Globe category.
No, it's only undeserving recipients who win Golden Globes, so maybe on the Academy Award show. Jeffrey right. Weeks called Homosexual Oppression and Liberation a map to the ideas of gay liberation. And Robert Moore, and I believe you make this point in your introduction to the reprinting of Homosexual Oppression and Liberation, which we might just call Homosexual going forward. But Robert Moore, who compared Monday conference on ABC, called it a personal attack on conventional morality, which I imagine you were probably quite pleased about.
Yes, and I should explain. Monday conference was, in a sense, the precursor of Q&A. It was a 50-minute ABC program in which one person got to engage with the panel, and Bob Moore, who was the compere, had me on when the book was published in Australia, and I had great delight in talking with, I remember, two extremely conservative men, and they were, of course, men, because in those days nobody cared about gender balance, one of whom was still vehemently defending the idea that homosexual behaviour should remain illegal. And that's sort of a mark, isn't it, of how far we've gone. That
well,
now,
I'm actually surprised that it was just one on the panel.
The other one was a well-meaning cleric who was, you know, well-meaning clerics are the worst. I'd much rather have non-well-meaning clerics, because then you can just hate them, which is what I think one should do to the clergy in general. But if they're well-meaning, you know, it becomes morally more ambiguous. I do remember, seeing we're going down this nostalgia trip, I do remember another panel where I had to spend 40 minutes, basically, every time I spoke, saying, I cannot call you father. You are not my father. And the gall of the Catholic Church to require us to refer to people to whom we have no relationship as father, mother, sister, etc., has always been to me quite extraordinary. And that people go along with that is even more extraordinary. So, yeah, I've done my anti-religious tirade. Let's talk about film.
Well, we are, of course, talking about homosexual representation. And we did have Ruby Rich on the program at the beginning of last month. Ruby Rich.
On our first program.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The very first Outtakes program. Ruby Rich, for people who weren't listening then, and why not? But no, for people.
I was listening.
Good, as you should have been. No, Ruby Rich coined the phrase queer cinema. Mm-hmm. Of course, before then, you know, there was queer representation, but we didn't really have a body of film that spoke to queer identity. And this is what Ruby Rich had to say about queer representation.
You know, we have a genre of filmmaking now where we used to have nothing but a barren wasteland. And yet every generation, which in the queer world seems to be about every 3 years, every generation seems to want once again to have the very basic lines of their story outlined again for them. I think that people want signposts and compass directions.
Do minority groups look to popular forms of representation more for that comfort?
I think they do, and I think there's a particular anxiety about it because of the history of misrepresentations and stereotyping. I think in the beginning, people were very cautious, and I used to laugh about that and say, oh, yes, this is yet another documentary that proves that homosexuals eat with a knife and fork, too, and know which spoon to use for the soup. But I think we're past that. I think that we're in an era when the imagination really needs to be plumbed much more deeply, And we're also in such fascinating and distressing times of backlash, of new threats, of new celebration, of new rights. It's hard to sort it out. And I think that we need our films and television to sort it out for us, to help us sort it out, to help move people past predictable expectations and predictable outlooks. And I always think that films that can unsettle their audiences are doing something important.
Well, there you have it. That was Ruby Rich talking about, I guess, the importance of queer representation. But she also was talking about, you know, the climate for queer filmmaking now is far more liberal than it once was. In fact, she called it a barren wasteland. And I suppose, Dennis, in your work, that might be what you call repression, or the era of repression.
Well, I think she's referring to a very long period when everything had to be coded. And, you know, there are some very famous and classic examples. I don't think, by the way, Ruby Rich coined the phrase queer cinema.
Really?
But anyway, no, I'm sure she didn't. I think that phrase floated around. But the point is, if you think back to the sorts of roles that someone like Marlene Dietrich often played,
sure,
there was, of course, a way in which any lesbian in the audience would have seen and identified. And it's interesting because one can think of a number of women, one can think of a number of films from the golden age of Hollywood in which that's clearly happening. Mm-hmm. It's much harder when you think of the men, because with the men they tended either to be presented as figures of fun, so you know, had, yes, the figures, yeah, of ridicule,
the sissy, for example,
the sissy boy, exactly, the, mm-hmm, Edward Horton. Anyway, very plain. Okay, none of us know.
You're getting,
okay,
blank stares, aren't,
okay,
you?
Okay, I expect...
Everett Horton.
Thank you, exactly. I was getting him mixed up with J. Edgar Hoover, who was, after all, the closet queen of another sort.
That's true.
But you either had that, or occasionally, I guess, you had the sort of reference, you know, somebody was a bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, bachelor is a term that seems to come up a lot in pre-liberation cinema. And again, I suspect for gay men of the period, that was read in a certain way.
Well, I think it was confirmed bachelor was how you'd read,
right,
that.
Yes.
He's a confirmed bachelor who was flamboyant.
Well, I think the key word there is read. It was all about the reading of the text, because the text was quite, in many ways, quite neutral. And it was about what obviously I wasn't around then, but we as audiences could glean from a text, the crumbs that we could take and put together to affirm some sense of self.
And every now and then, of course, people smuggled it in. I mean, Gore Vidal used to boast with glee of the way in which he inserted a homoerotic scene into the screenplay of Ben-Hur.
Yes,
film adaptations of Tennessee Williams plays, particularly Suddenly Last Summer, mm-hmm, which ends with Sebastian being mauled to death by a pack of young boys.
It's such a fantastic film, Suddenly Last Summer, and I think this film, as well as any film, you really get a sense of how filmmakers were trying to insert a homosexual subplot, what we might call a homosexual plot, without actually explicating it. It was entirely inferred, but it was so clear.
And of course, we had the early Hitchcocks. We had Rope.
Oh, absolutely. Such a classic story
and
as well.
Strangers on a Train. And, of course, we owe a great debt to Patricia Highsmith's novels, because Carol, which I think opens this week, is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel.
Which she, funnily enough, didn't publish under her name because she was coming off first novel, which had done so well, and the publisher was quite concerned about putting this work out. But I think the point you make about something like Suddenly Last Summer is a really valid point. And, in fact, for those who haven't seen Suddenly Last Summer, I'm going to play a clip which is from towards the end of the film when Elizabeth Taylor is talking about the character of Sebastian and about, you know, actually we've got some of the sound from it in our introduction at the beginning of the show, but about how he used women to procure for him, and then it kind of segues into her recollecting what happens to him ultimately. So it's a really fascinating clip. This is Suddenly Last Summer on Outtakes.
We were decoys.
Decoys?
For Sebastian, he used us as bait. And when she was no longer able to lure the better fish into the net, he let her go.
Bait for what? What were the better fish?
We procured for him when he tried to escape from the streets. down those little side streets between the buildings. They came from everywhere. He screamed just once.
There you go. Suddenly Last Summer. Such a fascinating clip. Such a great, great film as well.
You know, I can't say that I've actually... I can't remember watching it, but listening to
you
that
must
clip...
You must have seen it.
Listening to that clip, it's triggering a memory, but I need to go out and see it.
I think the point that is made in The Celluloid Closet, which for people playing along at home is perhaps the best documentary about queer cinema.
Can we stop?
It's actually a
book.
Well, it is. It's based on a book.
About the book. Because this is the same problem. We talk about Suddenly Last Summer. Mm-hmm. Remember, we're talking about a play by Tennessee Williams. Yes. And the film is a secondary representation of what the playwright had done. Just The Celluloid Closet is based on a book. This is me as an author speaking, but it's actually quite important.
I think the text is substantially different, Suddenly Last Summer, to the film. And obviously there were certain... I mean, Williams had to... obviously had certain senses that he needed to worry about. But when we talk about Hollywood representation, these films... And I use the word film purposefully, are so important because they do, you do get a sense of the production codes that were around at the time and what they said about morality at the time or people's
censorship.
Ideas about morality. And a film like this, the film, is really interesting because, and I think you really do get a sense of how... people are trying to say something without saying it. I mean, nowadays, if we saw this on our screens, the film could be set into something like two lines. You know, he was a homosexual, and therefore, you know, he was gay-bashed.
And who preyed on rent boys.
Well, there you go.
That's essentially what she's saying, that she would procure boys for sex.
Oh.
Dennis, what do you think?
I just sighed. Well, I think that this, at one level you're right, but that's not, I think, how a Tennessee Williams play works.
No.
You know, it works on a number of different levels. I agree with you. It is a very powerful film, and I can't remember the play well enough. I actually have very strong, vivid images from the film, you know, Katharine Hepburn coming down in the lift, Elizabeth Taylor losing it, Sebastian being mauled on the rocks at the end. But, I mean, I suppose my point is you keep, Daniel, talking about texts, and I want to go back and remind people that a lot of the films we're going to talk about actually originated as novels and plays.
Why do you think that's important, particularly for what we're talking about? Obviously, there are other reasons why it's important, but when we talk about queer representation, why is it significant that so many of the major queer films, and you're right to note that most of them actually, especially at this time, did stem from text or written text. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I suspect, you know, that with something like Suddenly Last Summer or Streetcar Named Desire...
Yeah.
The reality was that because Tennessee Williams was, at that point, number one in the American theatre, that A, made it likely to make money, and B, gave artistic license.
Yes.
So filmmakers, you know, let's be honest, Hollywood is not full of people with massive imaginations.
No, actually, that's quite true. If we look at the films coming out of Hollywood now...
They cannibalise. You know, I didn't really come on to be a spokesperson of the Australian Society of Authors. I feel as if that's what I'm doing. But I guess my point is exactly the point you've made, that a lot of the films we talk about originated out of novels and plays. And, of course, I absolutely agree. The film then becomes this extraordinary medium that takes those very small, you know, very small audiences that are available. Suddenly, there's a mass audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, some kid growing up in Topeka, Kansas, got to see Sebastian. Well, maybe Sebastian wasn't the best role model if you're growing up in Topeka, Kansas, but, you know, you get to see it. And in that sense, of course, the coded references suddenly take on a whole set of other meanings.
And when we talk about representation as well as a factor that determines identity, and I, you know, I think a lot of people would agree that it can do. I think these cinematic representations have a lot more weight. They have a lot more influencing potential.
Well, I think that depends, because I'm from a generation for whom books were the central way. And I think that for older lesbians and gay men, there was a sense in which we sought out literature, because there weren't, other than these very coded references, there weren't the films. There certainly wasn't the television. I mean, I contrast this with a story I like telling of my nephew who came out when he was 17, and he came out and his mother rang us to tell us at exactly the moment Kurt was coming out to his father on Glee on the television screen. And that, to me, you know, sums up an enormous cultural shift.
Doesn't it, though? That's such a fascinating story. And I think that really does demonstrate how influential representation is. And but it also goes the other way as well. And it's
do you find, though, that the representations that were available in film at that time were just tantalizing? And so they were so tantalizing that is this what drove people to find it in the written word?
No, I think that I guess there just wasn't that much around. And I'm trying to remember, the reason I'm hesitating is I'm trying to remember the first homosexual references on film that I'm aware of. And it isn't the first, but one of the things I remember very clearly, which goes back to, I guess, the early 70s, was the film Sunday Bloody Sunday, in which there's this wonderful triangle. Mm. And Murray Head, whom I thought was absolutely gorgeous, at one point...
Alan is nodding his head in agreement.
We can agree on Murray Head's gorgeous. Yeah. It's okay. Anyway, at one point, Murray Head kisses Peter Finch. There's this long kiss, and I still remember a literal gasp in the audience. Yeah. I can also remember a scene in Darling, a film with Julie Christie that does go back to when I was an undergraduate in the 60s, in which there was a gay character. He was not the lead character, but he was clearly gay. And I think that, you know, probably from the early 60s on, characters who were recognisably gay started showing up in film.
Oh, I see. So apart from just coded references that we saw from films from the pre-50s. Yeah. And I think those coded references, do you not feel that because they were coded and in many ways subliminal or sub-vocal, was that a positive message?
I think it depended.
Was it still a positive?
I suspect, you know, I think women had a lot more, because they did have those very strong female characters who were deliberately flirting with the possibility of both androgyny and lesbianism. And as I say, you think of the way in which Marlena Dietrich or Betty Davis, you think of a film like All About Eve, you know, it's full of ways in which a woman who's attracted to other women might actually identify, although you couldn't probably find any lines in the script that would suggest that.
Yeah.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9, Daniel and Alan and the wonderful Dennis Altman. And we've been talking about homosexual representation and the way that that representation shapes identity. We've been talking a lot about what we might call the repressed period in Hollywood. But I think, you know, we did start touching on the idea of coming out. And a lot of your work, Dennis, tends to deal with the theme of coming out, of liberation. I wonder for you what it was like at that time in the 70s when it felt, did it feel like the world was coming out almost?
Well, I don't think I thought the world was coming out. I might have had a much more interesting sex life if the world coming out. Although, you know, enough people were coming out. I'm not complaining. But I think what was different, but this isn't really talking about film, but I think it's important, is that the gay movement, which was the term we used, and that included women as well as men, actually saw itself as part of larger social transformation. Mm. And I think we've lost that. I think that we've become essentially a very respectable pressure group type of movement. Mm. But in terms of representation, I think that from the end of the 60s on, there was an explosion, particularly in Europe, including the UK, far less in the US. It took them a lot longer. But, of course, also in Australia, in an odd way, on television, because we had that series Number 96. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about representations that shaped the views of how people saw homosexuality in Australia, I suspect the single most important figure is Joe Hashem's character in Number 96, who was this lovely gay boy whom everybody adored, and who was open and out in a way that didn't then happen again in Australian soap opera for 30 years.
It's incredible when you think about it that it's been a 30-year lag between Number 96 and was it Home and Away or Neighbours?
I guess, but I've got too old to watch soap operas now. You know, I watch things like the
I don't know that there's ever a good time
to watch. Abbey, of course, has a gay character who's suffering appallingly.
But one of the things that I noted in your writing, Dennis, was that you make the point that homosexual people, if I can use that phrase, are still different to other people because, and one of the reasons is because they still have to come out. So this is an enduring.
Well, I mean, firstly, I don't think there are such things as homosexual people, but okay, people who want to express their homosexuality have to come out. That's true, but the social conditions are extremely different.
Yes.
I mean, as you've been talking, I've been thinking of my experiences last year when I went to the Queer Film Festival in Bombay.
Yes.
And the point you were making, or that's come up, about the need for people to see images of themselves was very, very evident in an audience, most of whom had not had access in cinemas. But the point is they had access through the internet, so that the world today is extremely different. And I think that it may well be that that central role of film in the coming out experience is already over.
Yes.
Because now there is so much. You know, I don't know at what age people go on Scruff and Grindr and the rest of them. One assumes...
They won't tell you their real age anyway.
Well, exactly. But, you know, I don't think they're all of legal age. But the point is that I'm being a bit frivolous. There's a serious point, which is there's a flood of information, visibility, imagery that wasn't available, what, even 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago. So I think that central role of film, which you're quite right, in the coming out story is probably declining.
But I would say that with most coming out stories on film usually are accompanied by a love story. They usually go hand in hand. I think the love story is universal, and we see that time and time and time again. I mean, it's actually an industry.
Yes.
So,
but see, that's the whole point about why I'm uncomfortable about the term homosexual people and the idea of people coming out, because the most interesting film is often film which throws into question somebody's sexuality. I mean, I gave that example of the reason Murray Head and Peter Finch kissing is so dramatic is precisely because Murray Head is also having an affair with Glenda Jackson.
Yes.
And I think of a contemporary example. There's a French film, and one of you may know the name. It's a lovely film in which a gay guy, and, you know, he's identified, everyone sees him as gay, he's had a long-term relationship, he falls in love with a woman. Mm-hmm. And nobody, including him, knows how to deal with it. So coming out is actually reversed. Well, he has to come out as heterosexual.
Yeah. There are a number of stories that do that. And for me, what I find interesting nowadays on screen is when you have a story that is ostensibly about homosexual people, and I know that phrase is problematic, and I look forward to hearing why, but I like seeing on screen nowadays, which is becoming increasingly more
prevalent.
Yeah, yep. Where they're not, the story's not about their homosexuality.
No.
A really interesting film that I saw just the other day, which is coming to Acme in a couple of weeks' time, is called Nasty Baby. And this is a film, it stars Kristen Wiig, directed by Sebastian Silva, that you think starts out about this woman wanting to have a baby with her gay best friend, but it turns into something that has nothing to do with that by the end of the film. And it's shocking precisely because it subverts those expectations we're so used to seeing when we go to the cinema or wherever it is that we're watching queer representation. We're so used to seeing the stories about the homosexual feelings, the, you know, love, pain, whatever it is, but we're not really used to seeing homosexual characters that aren't there to explore their homosexuality.
That's right. I think we definitely do crave to see films that are exploring more than homosexuality. They're exploring real life issues and our own day-to-day lives.
I think really it is a symbol of the times and what we might call progress. Dennis, I'm interested to know how you find the phrase a homosexual person problematic.
Well, I think it's an interesting question, seeing you've been reading me, and I probably felt much more strongly about it at the time I wrote the book that you're now reading. I think that there is this, it's the phrase itself is okay. It's the implication of it that we are somehow, and it, because of the way the conversation was going, that we are a separate people, that somehow being gay is a primary identity. And I think for most people, it's not. It becomes in certain times and places a primary identity. Mm-hmm. But it strikes me as a complicated term that's probably unnecessary. I think we can just say homosexuals rather than homosexual people.
I think what Daniel meant by homosexual people was we're trying to be all-inclusive as a full umbrella of the various terms. I think you refer to it as alphabet soup, Dennis, in your books.
A lot of people refer to it.
Oh, yes. I'm not going to claim I invented that term.
No. Dennis, we were chatting before the program, and I asked you about some of the films that resonated with you. And one of the, I guess it's a miniseries that you mentioned, which is interestingly, again, a play that was turned into a miniseries, is Angels in America. And I think Angels in America... I think it really explores this idea of change and coming out in a way that not a lot of other texts do.
Well, look, I think, I mean, the reality is that Angels is a product of the AIDS epidemic.
And it, yes.
You know, the homosexuality in Angels is impossible to separate from the impact of the epidemic and the fact that people are dying from the epidemic. And, of course, it does explore in all sorts of very interesting ways the politics around sexual identity, both through the two young men.
Yes.
Or three young men, but also, of course, through the figure of, I've forgotten his name.
Roy Cohen.
Yeah. Who'd been Senator McCarthy's right-hand man. I was actually tempted to say his bum boy, but...
I think that's what they call him. Do they call him a butt boy? I think he's referred to that in the film anyway.
I think I could quote Tony Kushner. Interestingly, of course, again, I'm going to stress, you know, Angels in America is a play. It's
yes.
a two-part
mm-hmm.
play. The film version, Tony Kushner, who wrote the play, collaborated with Mike Nichols. I actually think it's a much stronger piece of work than the play. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The plays were redone in Sydney, 2 years ago now, and seeing it, it actually doesn't work as well, I think, as the cinematic version. So, you know, I'm trying to be generous here.
Well, no, look, you were speaking about Roy Cohn, who is an interesting figure in the way that he deals with the stigma of being homosexual. And here's what he has to say at one point when he finds out that he's been diagnosed with HIV, or I think maybe even AIDS. And this is what he has to say about what that means for his sexuality.
You know, your problem, Henry, is that you are hung up on words, on labels, that you believe they mean what they seem to mean. AIDS, homosexual, gay, lesbian, you think these are names that tell you who someone sleeps with? They don't tell you that.
No?
No. Like all labels, they tell you one thing only. Where does an individual so identified fit in the food chain? In the pecking order. Not ideology or sexual taste, but something much simpler. Clout. Not who I fuck or who fucks me, but who will pick up the phone when I call, who owes me favors. This is what a label refers to. Now, to someone who does not understand this, homosexual is what I am because I have sex with men. But really, this is wrong. Homosexuals are not men who sleep with other men. Homosexuals are men who, in 15 years of trying, cannot pass a pissant anti-discrimination bill through city council. Homosexuals are men who know nobody and who nobody knows, who have zero clout. Does this sound like me, Henry?
Dennis, you're chuckling.
Well, I think it's a really interesting clip that you found. And, of course, this is poetic license, right? This is not what Roy Cohn would ever have said. It's what Tony Kushner would like Roy Cohn to have said.
I think so.
And I think it's an absolutely fascinating text that can be read in all sorts of ways. But, of course, I think the real point that about Roy Cohen, and indeed, if we go back to my comment about Jade Gahoover, is the self-hatred and the inability to acknowledge in any way their sexuality. And I think that's, of course, the whole point of Angels is that he dies.
Well, I think that is one of the things that Angels does so, so well, is give you a real sense of the pain associated with coming out, or the pain associated with being gay or homosexual at the time. I think Kushner does such a wonderful job at evoking that pain, and I dare say that's probably why it's had so much resonance. There are a number of other reasons, but
I think Angels is much bigger in the sense that I think it has so much resonance because it is actually a play about America.
Yes.
And it's in the tradition of Walt Whitman, of this sort of, who was also homosexual,
yes,
this grand ability to somehow, through the imagination, say something about the United States. And, of course, through the prism of an epidemic when people were dying. And it's almost impossible now, I think, to capture what that play meant when it first went on in the 90s.
But what, for me, I take as a reader today is that what I think Kushner does so well is that it's almost as if the pain associated with coming out becomes a metaphor for the pain associated with progressing as a nation.
Yes, it's interesting. I wouldn't have seen the coming out as central. I mean, to me, and this goes back to something Alan said, to me it's actually the love, it's the betrayal, and I'm now trying to remember the names of the characters, so you'll have to correct me, but Lewis,
yes,
who betrays his lover. Joe is the Mormon boy, I
yes,
think.
Yes, Joe.
Yeah. And his relationship to his wife, who then goes crazy. The nurse.
Oh, she is crazy to begin.
That's
I think
true.
She kind of clarifies towards the end. And there's this wonderful scene in the film where she's talking to a statue of a Mormon, and she asks about change. And this is how that scene plays out.
In your experience of the world, how do people change?
Well, it has something to do with God, so it's not very nice. God splits the skin with a jagged thumbnail from throat to belly, then plunges a huge, filthy hand in. He grabs hold of your bloody tubes, and they slip to evade his grasp, but he squeezes hard, he insists. He pulls and pulls, till all your innards are yanked out. And the pain, can't even talk about that. And then he stuffs them back, dirty, tangled. It's up to you to do the stitching.
Get up and walk around.
Just mangled guts pretending.
Yeah. That's how people change.
There you go. So the idea that people change by having their insides kind of ripped out of them and then kind of stuffed back in, and they've got no choice but to kind of go on.
Yeah.
What do you think, Dennis, about, you know, as a metaphor for coming out and
I don't think it is a coming out film. I think that we're just seeing it in quite different ways. I think that to try and talk about coming out in terms of Angels is just not what the play is about.
What and about what the character of Joe, who does...
Well, Joe, yes, but I think that there, what Kushner is... It's not whether Joe comes out. It's how Joe deals with his feelings, whether he... Coming out for Joe involves leaving a marriage that he's entered into because of social pressure, and you could say, yes, that's coming out. But it's certainly not a triumphal coming out story.
No.
And the central gay characters in the... I mean, there's a range, isn't there? Lewis and Lewis's boyfriend, whose name is... Alan's got a
Pryor.
Pryor. Who is, of course, the one who dies and who is very ill and who is visited by the angel.
I don't think Pryor dies at the end. He gets very sick and then he gets better towards the end.
Well, that's right, he does, doesn't he, in the final scene there in Central Park.
That's right.
And Pryor is visited by the angel.
Yes.
And I must say that I remain totally unclear about the symbolic meaning of the angels in Angels in America. But I think that that is a mystery that even Tony Kushner himself probably isn't quite clear about.
He probably doesn't know why he put half the stuff in there.
I mean, it's a mystery to everybody, but I guess for me, when I think of Angels in America, and you're saying that the reference to angels, whenever they talk about America, it's always God bless America, and I guess angels are associated with
I think that's
God.
That's a very that's big it. Part of it, yes. Mm. But, I mean, there are all sorts of very complicated overlays, aren't there? Because there's also the beginning of Perestroika, which is the second part, where the elderly rabbi comes on.
played mm-hmm. by Meryl Streep.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Or in, if you happen to see it in Sydney, played by Robert Neville, I think. And the elderly rabbi disappears.
Yes.
And you think, oy vey, what is this elderly rabbi there for? Come back. Oh, actually, probably don't come back, please. It's gone on long enough.
Yeah.
I think that Angels is a wonderful example, Alan, of what you said earlier. It's when you have gay characters, but that's not what the play's about. I mean, the play's about mm-hmm. something much bigger. And, of course, it's gay in the sense that the AIDS epidemic in Western countries was predominantly experienced by, affected, and then was responded to by gay men.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, only part of what Angels is. So I see it as it's really interesting this come up. I did list it. You're right, Daniel. It was one of the films I mentioned to you. But it's not what one would think of when I'm talking about classically gay films.
I think you have made the point that it does speak to this time when there was a terrible pain and tension around the AIDS epidemic. And mm-hmm. We know that that was one of the mobilizing factors that led to what Ruby Ridge, perhaps contentiously, has coined queer cinema. So it was, I think Angels in America does represent that tension quite well.
Angels in America represents the fact that people were dying.
Yes.
You don't need to talk about queer cinema. For God's sake, we're talking about the fact that the person who wrote Angels, the people who did Angels, were people whose families, whose lovers, whose worlds were dying. It's not about inventing a new form of cinema. It's about expressing the pain of death and disease that at that stage nobody knew what to do about.
No, but I think we can acknowledge that it is important and it was important and it still is important that pain and death is represented so that we can, you know, it's sometimes important to see these things played out.
Yes, but then we're talking about what cinema does. It has nothing to do, I think, whether it's gay cinema or not. I mean, the same, you know, to me, the parallels would be the films that have come out of memories of the Holocaust.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I want to say very carefully, I do not regard AIDS as a Holocaust. And I think when people like Larry Kramer call it a Holocaust, they're actually doing a very, very grave misuse of the term. Mm-hmm. But I think that that's the parallel, that mm-hmm. you know, great tragic events do produce and generate, can produce, and it always, great works of art. But in this case, the great work of art transcends the sorts of questions that people usually, I mean, they're really good questions, mm-hmm. but they're not the sort of questions one usually would talk about if we're talking about representations of gayness in cinema.
But I think that from what you're saying, that this was a film about people who had died, and it gets back to that idea that stories need to be told. People need to tell their stories.
And I think those stories
really important.
Yeah. Then become part of the cultural canon that we take with us as we, you know, become these people,
yes.
these gay and homosexual people. This is becomes part of a legacy almost.
Mm. Well, I think that the reason yep. Angels is so interesting, the reason probably we're talking about it tonight, is that it's not in a realist tradition.
No.
Whereas most of the films one thinks of as, you know, lesbian, gay film or
yes.
queer film, whatever, although we haven't actually talked about anything that I think is
decidedly queer.
Exactly.
No.
That's why part of the reason why I think it's slightly irrelevant to tonight. But in any case, most of the films we talk about are very realist. I mean, even a film like Holding the Man, mm-hmm. which in a sense is the Australian story
yes.
of the epidemic, is a very realist film. It is actually telling us a story in fairly traditional, I think very good and very moving ways, of two people who met, who got sick, who died. And it's
yes.
a realist story, and it includes, I mean, you're absolutely right, there are lots of coming out scenes in Holding the Man. But it's very different to Angels, which works on a whole set of different levels, doesn't it? Mm. Of allegories, of references.
But this style of allegory and reference and, you know, like irony and pastiche, it does feel a lot more like the landscape of trauma and memory. And in many ways, the style there informs the content. And that is why
yes.
it is such an interesting text.
And that's why there is nothing else, I think, that has come out of the AIDS epidemic that is on that level. I mean, I think Angels in America stands above, and there's lots of other stuff. And I do actually think that Holding the Man is as good as anything else that's been made anywhere in the world, except for Angels, which I place in the Well, because Angels is about so much more. And its ambitions are so much greater. And I'm not, that's not a criticism of Holding the Man. It's just a reality. I think, as I say, Holding the Man is certainly worth noting. It stands up very, very well against, you know, the, if you think of the American films about the epidemic. What have you got?
Philadelphia.
Which is crap.
Yes.
I mean, we cry, but it's still a bit crappy.
It's Hollywood cinema.
Yeah, exactly.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are on Outtakes here on Joy 94.9. It's almost the end of another program, but we do have this little game that we play on the show, Dennis, hoping that you would indulge us. So the game is called 15 in 15. Basically, we chuck as many film questions at you in 15 seconds, and we see how many you can answer. I think right now the best on the program to date is 5 answers. So how do you feel about your chances of...
Very bad.
Very bad. All right. Well, look, there's no pressure, but here we go, 15 in 15.
The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Worst film franchise.
Myra Breckinridge.
Best animation film.
Alice in Wonderland, Disney.
Favourite film of all time.
Oh, do I have to have one? All About Eve.
Snap out of it!
Ah, good choice.
Brilliant. Yeah,
well, there
that.
You go. You got 4.
Good
which,
choice.
I got 5, I beg your pardon.
Oh, you were counting. Was it 5?
Absolutely. I got every single one.
Okay. We'll give you 5. There you are. You've equaled the best on Outtakes so far, so we'll just have to make sure that no one surpasses that.
Well, you know, it's pretty simple. My advice to anyone who comes on this program is just know the names of 5 films and you're set.
Well, we have had a message in from a listener saying, and what about And the Band Played On as an AIDS movie? Thoughts?
I wasn't thinking about the documentaries. I mean, there's a whole series of documentaries.
And some of them are fantastic as well.
Well, I think they are all exercises in myth-making. We could have another hour discussion
we
about
could.
That.
We could. So on that note, that very controversial note, which we
of
might
myth-making.
Perhaps not agree with, we're going to have to say, have a good evening from the team at Outtakes. You are on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.